I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. My sister wrote a poem that was affixed up in our dining room, or our breakfast room, in Ottawa, Ontario, where we lived. I don't know when she wrote it, but this is my sister Rachel, and she was far beyond her years, and still is, in smarts. She wrote, "Spring is here, flowers are near, the birds are singing, and I am swinging. Winter is past, and I'm happy at last." It's funny that I can still remember that poem, but there's a perennial beauty about spring and how it brings an abundance to us. And as a chef, you know, we revel in the time where we get spring garlic and fava beans and English peas and young radishes and all those new crops that come up and excite us, like asparagus. There's another chef I know, as most chefs are excited about it, but this chef is particularly excited about vegetables. And he started a company around it, and it's a really intriguing story. So on today's show, I visit Chef Dan Barber at his Greenwich Village farm-to-table restaurant, the OG of farm-to-table, and that's Blue Hill. It's not the Blue Hill at Stone Barn. It's the Blue Hill, the original one, in the village. And it's won a ton of accolades and produces some of the most elevated vegetable dishes in New York. Dan Barber grows a lot of those vegetables himself, and we'll talk about that in the episode. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it and write a review on your podcast app. That will help other people find it. We all need a roadmap sometimes. If you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Adam Platt Eats an Amazing Sandwich and last week's episode, Matt and Ted Lee Explain Hotboxes. Here's this week's conversation. Dan Barber plants a seed. Dan Barber. Good to be here. Good to see you after many, many years.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to town here. It's awesome to have you.
Yeah, it's good to be in the village right next to NYU and all the activity. The park seems to be bustling right now. Pigeon Man was there covering pigeons.
Bunch of drug dealers, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, too. So we are at Blue Hill, not at Stone Barn. We're in the city in Greenwich Village. So this restaurant's been around how long now?
20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, we're going on 20.
I opened up my 5 and 10 18 years ago.
Okay.
So that's crazy how these things go. Hmm. And initially it was you and Michael Anthony.
Michael was the co-chef with me, but that wasn't when we opened. That was a couple years afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Initially, I had a chef here named Alex Urena.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did Alex go?
You know, he's in D.C. now at a restaurant. I've forgotten the name of it.
So the restaurant's 20 years old now, and then you opened up Blue Hill at Stone Barn 8 years ago?
Blue Hill at Stone Barn's 14.
14 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. 2004, so.
That's right amazing. Yeah. You guys just got a new Michelin star here? Shiny new one?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
Well, let's talk about seeds, and let's. I'm really good friends with an amazing Southern writer named Janice Ray.
Oh.
Janice Ray wrote a book called *The Seed Underground*.
Oh yes, yes. Oh yes.
Which is really
really
interesting book on seed stock and how we're basically the risk assessment of seeds and an abundance of different varietals is we've got a safety measure against blight and different things coming into the agricultural system that can devastate crops. And differentiating between seed stock allows us that safety net of some things are going to continue to thrive. So with this company and your initiative that you've started, you guys are going after seeds that will do what exactly? They're basically propelled on flavor profiles combined with
the flavor deliciousness is sort of the
mandate.
It's the mandate and it's the sort of operating instruction for the seed. But that's sort of our tagline is this return to the flavor mutiny kind of thing. But part and parcel with that is this idea that the seed needs to yield really well. It needs to perform well in the field. It needs to have good disease resistance. It needs to be a strong plant. It can't, you know, die when it rains too hard, you know, as some of these curveballs we get from weather patterns these days. So, you know, I've been a evangelist for like old seeds, you know, like heirloom, like all of us chefs, heirlooms and heritage breeds and everything, because because that's where the flavor is, you know. And as chefs, we like, makes us look like better chefs because that stuff is dialed in to, like, it's the reason it was passed down for generations. You know, it wasn't passed down for generations because it had good disease resistance. It was passed down for generations because somebody tasted that and was like, holy shit, I want my son or daughter to taste that. And like, then they just protected it, and you know, here we are. But the thing is, like, you know, to be an evangelist for that is to be an evangelist for flavor, which is great. What's not so great is that, you know, if you're interested in thinking about this in terms of changing our food system to getting more nutrient-dense food and more delicious food to everyone, to democratize the seed, well, then you can't talk about heirlooms and heritage breeds in that same breath.
Now you have to walk beyond it.
Yeah, because farmers can't produce that and make money. You need a Hugh and you need a Dan to support those kinds of seeds. So we started the seed company where we take the genetics from the past but marry them with modern varieties and select and reselect for real regionality. You know, what is it about a particular region, either through soil expression or through weather conditions, that express the best of the seed and you know, have a kind of yield and a productivity that excites a farmer to grow it.
But that seed selection and cross hybridization is not GMO.
No. I mean, look, GMO's genetic, you know, genetic manipulation. And whenever you do anything with a seed, whether you're saving it, as in you're selecting something from the field and saving it, or you're taking that seed and marrying it to a brother and a sister, you are manipulating the genes.
I mean,
that's right. So it's really misnamed. I mean, GMOs is really about transgenic, from what, you know, is the best way that I've come to like explain it, to the extent that I understand. I mean, it's really about taking a foreign gene, a gene that would never end up in the DNA of a plant, and inserting it.
You know,
it couldn't happen in nature. But
right.
There's a particular trait from, you know, from a grass gene or from a pig's heart that you want inserted into, you know, a corn gene. And that's like, whether it's for a particular advantage in terms of, you know, spraying a chemical that it doesn't react to, or a particular, you know, nutrient that isn't available in the plant, whatever it is. It's that you can insert that into the plant and make it perform or make it express things that it otherwise would never, ever be able to express if it were in, you know, nature's backyard. And so that's what a lot of people have objection to about it. It's that you're forcing human ingenuity on something that wouldn't happen naturally. So in this case, we are marrying things that would happen in nature, but we are doing it really with the most modern thing we're doing is speeded up time. We're doing what our great-great-grandparents did by marrying two varieties, putting them together, and getting their offspring. We're identifying two varieties that have traits that we want and putting them together. Sometimes in a menage a trois, we're combining genes. And because of computer modeling, because the genome is mapped, because we can predict these things very quickly, we can do with a seed what took our grandparents a lifetime to do, you know, in just a couple of years. And that's taking appropriate technology and marrying it with, you know, a kind of old world wisdom about flavor and food. Yeah, I think that what you say is right, is that you know, the way I think about this with the seed stuff is like the iPhone or Apple idea, is that every couple of years we're going to come out with an updated version of the thing we released. It's sort of like it's the opposite to the heirloom idea, that you protect one thing and carry it forward. I was sitting actually right where we're sitting many years ago with a collection of really great breeders from around the country. We came for this meeting, and I was still, you know, I was drinking the Kool-Aid of this whole idea, but I was also still stuck in this thing of, like, you know, carrying this past and like, because it has great rich stories. Besides the fact they taste so good, damn good, it's like, we have
a
story that's connected.
Yeah,
the narrative. And so
yeah.
At the table, it's like, that's something really special, right? And so I was talking about some variety of something, you know, that I was excited to, like, you know, to bring back up to date. I think it was a carrot from Frank, I can't remember. Anyway, one of the guys at the table was like, knew the breed and knew the guy who had bred it and said his name. And he was like, you know, that guy didn't stop breeding that carrot, you know, he just died. And if he were alive, he'd be sitting here
still
laughing at you, saying,
yeah.
What are you doing? You're genuflecting off of this variety that I just ran out of time.
Yeah.
It's like, it kept going. I had improvements every couple of years. And it was just that crisp moment. I was part of it, because I was embarrassed in front of this table of people, because they were all laughing at me. It was all a group of breeders. And I was like, you know, it's true. It's like, we've constructed this whole narrative of seeds as like capturing some essence of the past. In fact, the whole point of seeds the whole point of domesticating agriculture and keeping on top of it is to continue to
feed more people and make it more
adaptive to a particular place.
Right.
And when we do this heirloom thing, we're growing. Not only are we trying to grow the past, we're trying to capture the essence of the seed that's grown out of place. I mean, that carrot wasn't developed here. Our favorite heirloom tomatoes were not selected here. And so we're compromising, forgetting about the yield factor, which is like the 1% deal. It's also just, it's like we're just giving up on a lot because that thing was not developed for this particular environment, which is what you want for a seed.
Yeah, and I think that within the last, you know, up until the last 5 years, where there's been a shift in how the development of seed is done, primarily through companies like yours, is they're developing for taste and not just shelf stability.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, we can look at a beautiful tomato on a shelf in January at any supermarket and it still does not taste great.
Yeah.
But if you can come up with a honey nut squash in this varietal, the new one that you're talking about with 898 squash, that can last much longer, yeah, be cellared,
yeah,
then that's a great attribute.
Right, right.
But usually taste was just not considered in that scenario.
Right.
So it's kind of exciting. But some of the other...
That's right. It's putting taste at the forefront of this.
Because of the decision.
Well, you just said before we got on air here, you were saying, you know, that we're in the 18 years that we've been in business. It's like people have gone from protein-centric plates of food to trying to explore vegetables as center stage actors.
Which,
and if we're going to do that, we need the vegetables to taste good.
We do. Right? I mean,
that's at the heart of this. It's like you've got to breed for that.
The only way you can pay rent in New York is to charge $60 for a carrot salad. Yeah. Now, so this is very primarily important to our business decisions. But, I mean, that goes into a really interesting thing, is why do Americans historically hate vegetables? And my theory is that up until 20 years ago, chefs just didn't know how to cook vegetables.
Yeah. You know. I have a slightly different theory. I think that's right in the sense that chefs become this kind of broadcasting power of what the architecture of a plate of foods. I agree with that, except, you know, looking back just on the history of this country, it's like we were just such a rich country and we always ate high on the hog. We just, you know, things just flourished here. We were never forced into proteins, were just easy because you had tons of grain pretty early on and you had animals and you had space and you had virgin soils and you just like, you could constantly, you didn't have soils that were exhausted from 4,000, you know, from 2,000, 4,000 years of agriculture in Europe and Asia. And so you did anything here was like the Garden of Eden. And so we were never forced into the negotiations that create both beautiful cuisine, but also, you know, to eat those lowly grains and vegetables that are soil supporting and healthful. It's like we could eat high on the hog because we could afford to. So I think that's I think that's part and parcel of our food culture, is like sort of a lack of food culture. We're just rich, rich country, but rich agriculture. And that tends to have us eat.
I mean, I'm a Canadian kid who now lives in the American South, which is the storied place of culinary history in the States, much built on the painful reality of slavery
and
brought over experiences, Gullah Geechee country coming over from West Africa and be brought over. But, you know, so that style of food was always on, it wasn't protein rich, it was greens rich and cured meats and things like that.
Yeah, largely because it was brought from other cultures.
Other cultures,
No one could afford to eat like Americans.
Right.
And we now can't afford to eat like Americans.
But it's funny, because of that way that most of America ate, which was high on the hog and prime cuts and all this, I think that we learned to cook meats well in the sort of European French tradition, but we learned to cook vegetables very badly.
No, I think that's right. I think that's right.
Yeah. And, you know, but I mean, in the past 20 years, protein prices have gone up so much that I think that as chefs, we've had to reconsider the plate. And so we've looked at trends and realized that if a focus on a Nantes carrot can be attributable and can be a producer of money to the bottom line, then let's do it. But that necessitates a third wave of learning how to cook that and learning technique that's going to drive that center of the plate thing.
That's right.
So when you talk about some of the seeds you guys have come up with, tell me about the Badger Flame beet.
The Badger Flame beet
That's an old beet, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. No, I mean, yellow beets are old historically, but no, Badger Flame is a new variety coming out of University of Wisconsin. This guy named Irwin Goldman, who's just this brilliant beet and onion breeder. He's a fascinating, like, super cerebral guy.
Beet and onion breeder? What? That sounds so cool.
Yeah, he's very cool. And he's very, like I was just talking on the phone, so I was frustrated, you know, in the middle of winter, this is now 10 years ago when I was on this like, pretty meaningful phone call with him, but we used to get these diners came in just like, we don't have menus at Blue Hill, so the waiters would come to the table and ask for allergies and whatever. And we just started to get a slew of tickets in the kitchen that were like from anywhere from December to like May. It was like tables allergic to beets. I was like, where is this coming from? It's like, and what I learned was that like, you know, we used to serve multiple courses of beets during the winter. We sort of still do because we store like 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of beets. And so like people would wait a while to get into the restaurant and then like they'd sit down and, you know, they'd have a couple courses of beets and be like, what the hell is this all about? You know, and the captain who was relying on the tip was like, so immediately first thing, captain go to the table, welcome to Blue Hill, and they say, I hope you like beets. And the first reaction, somebody's like, just wait 2 months to get it. I'm not gonna have beets, I don't want my meal to be beets. And so they'd say, no, I don't like beets. So the captain would write on a ticket, table's allergic to beets. And I was like, what this? So I was just talking to Erwin, I was sort of like, you know, lamenting this. And he was like, you know, I've identified why people don't like beets.
It's not an allergy though, they just don't like them.
Well, he was in search as a beet breeder, and since this was what he did for a living, he wanted to, like, he figured out that there's this cluster of compounds called geosmin, and it creates this like highly tannic taste to us. It's sort of like, it has influences of it in red wine. I mean, there's stuff, and like kids are really sensitive to it, which is a lot of the reason why kids don't like beets, or they choke them down, or I used to anyway. And so, and he had just actually had grandchildren. He wanted them to be as proud, you know, wanted him to be a proud grandfather, a beet breeder, and they wouldn't eat his beets. So he went after this beet that, like, after identified this compound, he selected against it and created a beet that is very low in geosmin. We, along the way, we co-selected with it. So we were selecting for, you know, there's a wide variety of flavors here. And so he was shipping us, actually, yeah, his grad students, we paid for gas and tolls. And his grad students used to drive to Blue Hill with a trunk full of beets, and we do all these tasting with the cooks. And then, you know, if you take a beet, you split it in half, you keep half of it at the test field, and the other half you taste, and then we identify the ones we liked, and he put those back on the ground. That was for next year. So anyway, finally we get at the Badger beet, which he named this beautiful yellow beet that he named Badger. And I'll have you taste it today. It's like, it's really delicious, and it's very sweet, and it's like it's a gateway drug into beets.
But does that bitter compound dissipate in cooking?
It dissipates hugely in cooking.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Try eating raw beet.
Yeah. And raw shaved beets. And some people, they've kind of flourished in sort of modernist restaurants in the past few years.
Horrible.
And I'm always like,
they're so
don't
cloying.
Put raw
yeah,
beets.
Yeah, yeah, right. Right. And now we just serve them raw here as like a carpaccio.
Yeah.
But it was bred for that. So that's another thing about, you know, I mean, that's another thing about the company and about the idea of seed breeding is like, you know, you can start writing a recipe for a dish, not when it comes on your cutting board, and not as we have increasingly done over the last 20 years that we've had our restaurants with a farmer, you know, in conversation with a chef, but actually we can start thinking about the creation of a recipe with the breeder, with the true architect of how the thing's gonna taste, the blueprints. You can help shape the blueprints. That's a very fascinating conversation.
Yeah, and I think another one of the seeds that's really interesting to me, and I'd love to hear the story about why it was created, is in that quest for flavors that we love, sometimes there's contrasting things within that vegetable that are off-putting, and habanero is one of those things. Yeah. The habanero has such a beautiful, distinct flavor
there
to
it is. Yeah.
But it is fiery, fiery pepper.
Right.
So you guys created the habanada.
Well, the breeding partner, the guy who started the company, this guy Mike Mazurek, who is a squash breeder and a pepper breeder, and he happens to not like heat. He doesn't like heat, and he also is offended by the habanero, especially the breeding work that's been done to habanero, which is to accentuate the heat, because that's what everyone wants, is to be floored by the heat. And he's like, that's ridiculous. It's the most beautiful melon citrusy pepper ever.
To and me, so, it's so Caribbean.
Right. Yeah.
There's a lot of history of that in my family, so it evokes
really?
A lot to me.
Yeah. So he selected against the heat, the capsaicin, and developed a habanata, which is a habanero without heat. It's fabulous. And also a good example of, like, you know, it was a little bit of a fun project, but it was also like, let's get people to appreciate what is so special about this habanero? Right. And think about a pepper in a whole different way.
Yeah, and that it's not the heat, because in the last few years, ghost chilies and Carolina Reapers are all the rage. But I mean, those are inedible peppers.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're so friggin' hot.
It's crazy. There's no point to them.
It's also that you experience a hot pepper the way a bird experiences it. He made this point to me. It's like, you know, the way peppers spread their seeds was through poultry, really through birds who didn't get affected by the heat. And so they would eat the pepper and then fly somewhere, the seeds would come out, and therefore peppers got to disperse around the world. And like, it's just an interesting way to, like, every time I eat the pepper, I'm just thinking, well, is that what bird experiences a habanero? That's cool.
Are there peppers growing in Washington Square Park?
Not yet. I hope so one day.
Someday. Yeah. So culinary leadership in the last 20 years, I think, has changed a lot. I think it's interesting to see, you know, to classify what we do as chefs. But it's intriguing to me is, economically, I'm a son of an economist. For the last 5 years, we've said, geez, there are no cooks out there. But now there's an unemployment at this really low rate. How do we find great people?
Yeah, that's a good question. How do we find great farmers and great people to work on the farm? And that's a great point.
I think the key is authenticity and constant teaching and an allowance and a progressiveness allow the workplace and the restaurant to be teeming with excitement about projects and things.
Yeah.
And giving an allowance to learn.
Yeah. I think you're describing is really a cooking school within the restaurant. And that's sort of where I think we're headed with this is like, maybe the cooking schools either need to radically rethink the way they teach food because from where you and I come from, it has to include the agriculture and the ecology of where food comes from. And that, you know, cooking schools are really lacking. But maybe restaurants become cooking schools, and that you pay to work with us because there's something there in terms of the education. I know people who work with you come away feeling like they just went to graduate school. And I'd like to think that's the direction where restaurants should be, high-end restaurants, or restaurants that can afford to do that kind of thing. Because that's a
But I think that exists in a lot of plays.
Yeah. Not formally. You don't get a certificate for it. I
mean, right. But you would have a lot of externships at Blue Hill.
Yeah, we do now. We have done half our kitchen, yeah.
Chez Panisse and Noma have been built on externships.
Right.
So it's an intriguing premise. But yeah, I think you have to give people a place where they can learn. You know, it's so hard in this economy that we, you know, the most we can pay is $16 an hour to a cook.
Right.
Yet, you know, there's nobody to work. And then, so how do you keep them there? Money aside, for the long term, not for a year, for 5 years.
Right.
So it's
where you get the benefit of the teaching.
Yeah. Well, let's pause and get a snack.
Okay, done. Let me, here, I'm not going to take this off.
Good, just put it in your pocket.
Environmental conditions has a lot to do with it, too. So this is beets grown in two different soils, but also picked at different times. So the orange ones is after a bit of a cold snap here, and the yellow ones is picked just, you know, a couple days before, also different soils.
The cold snap, did it freeze?
It didn't freeze, but it got super chilly.
Yeah.
So.
And which do you prefer?
I really prefer the orange ones, but, you know, the darker they went, because I think that is where the sugar gets expressed more. But the yellow ones are great, too. I don't know. Kind of choose your own adventure here. But it just shows that, like, you know, you can get all the genetics right, but if your soil's wrong or the conditions are wrong, well, that's the other third. And then, of course, you get in the kitchen, and if someone doesn't season it or overcooks the beets, then, you know, so then it's like, so it's just one third genetics, one third soil farming methodology, stewardship, and then it's one third kitchen. And as you know, the one third kitchen in this
is the most difficult one to get consistency.
Maybe. I mean, people talk about the weather, but I don't know, man. It's like your cook can get, you can do all this work, get the seed exactly right, get the soil conditions exactly right, and then, you know, the cook can screw this up in about 3 seconds. So,
and you know,
that's raw, by the way. That was just what you just tasted. Just had salt.
What we're looking at is two different colors of beets. One is, and they're both Badger Flame beets. One is striated in lines of what you'd expect out of a solid yellow beet that's almost got a Chioga striation of different color hues.
That's right.
And they're shaved lengthwise raw. next to them are a darker one where the striations are less visible, and it went through a cold snap and it's more mature. The sugars are starting to produce more naturally within the beet. It's less astringent than the other one, but the astringency, the sort of acidic compound of bitterness that we commonly get in beets is, even though these are raw, is magically low.
Yeah.
So it's very...
Or not magically,
intriguing.
It's purposefully.
Purposefully low. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So this was bred that way. Now, these ones were just shaved on a mandolin.
That's it. It has a little bit, a drop of lemon juice and some salt.
Yep. And there's olive oil in there?
There's no olive oil.
There's no oil? No. Well, it's just the maceration of the salts bringing out all that liquid.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, we're making a cocktail out of that.
That's awesome.
No.
It's really good.
Deucium, yeah. So then the other taste is more of like a story here. So
I'm looking at three squashes.
You're looking at three squashes. And
they've the story, been medievally pierced with
nails. The squash all the way to the left, the largest of the squash, just your workaday typical butternut squash. And that's what was in my kitchen when Michael Mazurek, the partner of Row 7, walked in. I invited him into the kitchen because I met him in the dining room. He came for dinner. And I was just so struck with the way he was talking about his breeding work and squash. And he just spoke like a chef. I was like, this guy was writing a recipe. It's like, I got him in the kitchen. And one of my cooks preparing, some puree or something for the next day with butternut squash. And I was like, it was late now. I was kind of just joking around with him. I was like, if you're such a great breeder, why don't you breed a butternut squash that actually tastes good? So we don't have to sit there and add like maple syrup and roast the hell out of it and get it caramelized and da-da-da, and do all these heroics to get some flavor. And I'll never forget what he said. He looked at me and he was like, in all my years of breeding, no one has ever asked me to select for flavor. Not one person. So that kickstarted the second squash you're looking at, which is now named the Honey Nut, but for many years was just a trial number or several different trials numbers, which the kitchen selected for the flavor and Michael was selecting in the field for all the attributes that we talked about, good yield and a strong plant and that disease resistance, et cetera, and came up with what is the Honey Nut. Now, the Honey Nut went from that funny little discussion that we had in our kitchen off the cuff to today being selling coast to coast. It's in major supermarkets. I just heard Blue Apron. Do you have Blue Apron down where you are? Yeah. They harvested 2.4 million pounds of it in October.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's in Trader Joe's, it's in Whole Foods, it's going into Costco. I mean, it's now getting to be everywhere. And what happened when Michael started showing this variety to distributors? Actually, one in particular held in his hand. He was like, no, this won't work. We don't have a SKU that would fit the squash. The SKU fits that. That's butternut squash. That's not, what is that? We'd have to develop a whole new language. It was just like, it was head spinning to me. Couldn't do it. And another one was just like, well, if you hold this butternut squash in your hand, and then in one hand, in the other hand, you hold this Honey Nut, which is what, half the size, no one's going to pay for a little bit more money for 50% less. That's quite a bit smaller. Now, of course, you know that 50% less is really what we're talking about is breeding out the water. So we have a much more intense flavored squash, a lot more nutrient density. So per spoonful, you're getting actually double what you're getting in the butternut squash. That's hard to explain to the, but what the guy was saying was like, nobody would go for that. Okay, so enter into, so this gave us a lot of confidence that, wait a minute, everyone's saying you can't do. No one's gonna buy this, at least in the mainstream. So we're like, but they're proven to be exactly wrong. And to your point, the reason this Honey Nut, the second squash you're looking at, got the liftoff is because I started giving it out to chefs, and they went fucking bonkers. It was like there was social media heaven, and they were just like, we've never met a squash. And as I said, as we know, anything that makes us look like better chefs, we just gravitate to it. It doesn't matter, like caviar, foie gras, whatever the hell it is, we're going for it. And that was a good example. And then people were forced to buy it. And like lightning, it went from this creative idea to a mainstream squash, which is, upending the butternut squash
market. But like any old heirloom seed stock, I think what you guys and what Row 7 is doing is you're creating that story.
Yeah.
Not creating the story. You're telling the story in a really good way that gives it the story that heirloom seeds really have.
Replacing that. That's right. Yeah. I think that's right. And the yield on the second Honey Nut that you're looking at is about 20 to 30% less than the butternut. So it's definitely, but it's not an heirloom. And it's, and if you give us some time and some money, which is why we started the company, we'll get there with some R&D, which is why I wanted to introduce to you number three squash that you're looking at, which is now a trial number 898. We just released it with the seed company this year. And what I was doing in the kitchen here this morning is I roasted it and I put it into this pot here with no salt, no pepper, no butter, no olive oil, no cream, no milk, okay? It's unplugged, 100% naked. And I was going to do a little dish for you, but I was like, what am I doing? The whole point of this is to talk about the breeder writing the recipe. Yeah. I just wanted you to take a bite of that with nothing in it.
So this is just whipped, mashed squash.
Yeah, with a
after
fork.
It's been roasted. Yeah. Was it roasted cut in half?
Cut in half, yeah.
And
yeah.
No seasoning on it?
No seasoning. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It's nuts, man.
Why does it need no seasoning? Everything needs seasoning.
I know.
That's
I know.
Crazy.
It's crazy.
Just
we're hitting it at its height.
The concentration of flavor is something that if you took the best squash ever and slowly roasted it with maple and a good amount of salt and everything
butter.
Else and butter, butter. And butter, yeah, because it's got that inherent
velvety.
Richness.
Yeah.
But you're right about breeding out for water because sometimes when you're doing vegetable purees with conventional vegetables, a lot of that taste that's occurring is just this sort of vapid wateriness to it.
Well, but breeding for the last 50 years has been about taking on water because that's where the farmer makes the money. Actually, not even the farmer, it's where the distributor makes the money because it's sold by weight. So there's been an incentive to breed for water, and water is free, or it used to be free in California.
It's
not anymore.
Not anymore.
But
wow.
Yeah, that's a game changer. And so this is, that's what I was saying about the iPhone is like, you know, this is the 2.0 version, but we'll have another 2.0 version.
Which is, I use the same thing with when talking about, you know, how often we update our phones or get new phones. And this is totally changing the subject, but I use it in an equation of how often we've changed and contemporized home ec curriculum in the last 50 years, which is never.
Yeah.
And yet we change our phones and update and feel the need to, you know, make sure our Wi-Fi is always on point. And
the culture is telling us that we need to be up to date with that.
But with these things,
but not these things. And that's what we need to change.
Yeah.
By the way, I shouldn't just say that it tastes so much better than this, although I think the flavor is a bit better than this. The main...
it's for shelf stability.
Yeah, it's the honey nut you taste that you did not taste, the Bravura squash that's taking over the country, only lasts until about Christmas at best. Really by Thanksgiving it's going downhill, so there's no storage. With the 898 experimental, Michael, this brilliant squash breeder, bred in storability attributes, which is really about a thicker skin, and now this stores until March. Which we tested last year. We were serving it in April.
You're harvesting in October or November.
Yeah.
And then you can sell her for 5-6 months.
Yeah. Well, that's the game changer. That's how it gets into the system. As much as this got in the system because of demand, this is a no-brainer. And the yield is more commensurate now as we're heading towards this. So that's just an example of like a chef asking a dumbass question.
So I guess, you know, it is interesting. The change in food that we're fighting against is a kind of a newfound phenomena. It starts in the 50s where technology, quote unquote, makes such progress that we have food storage and canning systems and all this that quadruples the amount of groceries available, right? But it strips away all the nutritional basis for it.
Yeah.
We start having to do things like mid-1940s, even as early as that, having to enrich rice because soldiers are falling over on the battlefield because there's no nutritional value in the rice that's being raised in America at that time. So how do we plan and create outside of, not the Row 7 Seeds is a limited scope, it's a pretty amazing endeavor, but how do we holistically look at making the food system, and not just for high-end restaurants, but for everyone, how do we make it more nutritionally dense and a better planned system that's available?
Well, so my argument for that would be to start at the seed level. Because if we're not breeding for what you just said, then we'll never get there. It doesn't matter how many local organic farms we have and how much enthusiasm and support we have from millennials and beyond. If the seed is not bred for the kind of flavor and nutrient density, by the way, we skipped over this, but flavor and nutrient density are one of the same thing. I did not understand that until I was studying how these genetics work and how you select. Because every time you select for flavonoids, it's flavor. It's one, you cannot escape it. You want something deeply and richly delicious, it is deeply and richly nutritious, period. I've never found that not to be true, except with sugar additions, you know, like donuts, I don't mean that. But with true flavor, there's no such thing as true flavor and bad nutrition. That's really interesting. I know, because we never talk about it.
Yeah.
We always think of something that's good for you as being less acceptable or difficult to literally swallow. It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
I think it's got to be whittled down to the, when we talk about that, it's the unprocessed purity of good food that tastes amazing and is concentrated is the most nutritious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is totally.
And that's a game that, you know, so we got to breed for that. And the second point I think to make about this is that we have to breed for it regionally. You know, if we're going to look at a food system like the one you advocate for, which is more nutrition, more flavor, more access, democratize these flavors. Well, that's why we started the company, was to do it on a regional level, because look at what chefs are doing today. I mean, as opposed to when you and I open our restaurants, I don't know about you, but down south, but when we're here in New York City, 20 years ago, I had to have foie gras on the menu to be foie gras or caviar or lobster or some combo platter of that to be understood and accepted
to
as
be
a high-end restaurant. To be
accepted as oat food.
Yeah, you had to be. And even though things were changing back then, I want to sound like my grandfather, it wasn't that, but you had to have that. Today, you have that on your menu and you're considered archaic and out of step.
Those things are called trappings for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And chefs have done that. To your point, chefs have really change the architecture and our expectations for what a plate of food is. A lot of that is driven by vegetables and grains. I agree with you. So this is just this company is just to recognize that, to say if that is the direction, because chefs, as we know, they start these trends that end up bleeding into the everyday food culture. It takes a little while.
They do, and it bleeds in, but then there's a sudden pushback. We saw that with kale. Kale had massive amounts of popularity. It was getting great. It was getting more widely acceptable, and then there was a kale backlash that nobody wants to order a kale salad anymore.
Is that right? Well, that might be in the restaurants, but it's in McDonald's.
It is McDonald's, so we've made a difference.
There's any kind of backlash, it's that the breeding stock of those of kale seeds just got decimated. I mean, you talk to these seed companies, they're just like overnight, where we had seed stocks, we couldn't push kale on anybody, all of a sudden we're depleted, and it takes years to bring back. I mean, those things happen with dizzying speed in America, you know? It's like, and the long game is this different architecture. We're not going to be looking at protein-centric plates of food when our kids are our age and their kids. We just, like, it's changing, and I think it's starting with chefs, and I do think that will bleed into the culture. And so a company that's breeding not just for vegetables to take center stage or grains, but also for regions to express themselves, because that's the key. It's like, that's also what people want now, and that's being reflected in high-end restaurants in the last 20 years. You know, whereas you had to have lobster, caviar, and foie gras through these majors, so you went to a restaurant, you expected that in some version, and today, you go to a high-end restaurant and you expect to have something in the region that you can't get elsewhere.
Right.
What is it about, you know, about the Pacific Northwest or particular micro-regions of the Pacific Northwest where I can get this and I can't get it elsewhere? And I want to document it through Instagram or whatever. Like that is the new generation of chefs and restaurants happening throughout the world. A very exciting food future, I think, is that you want this experience to be singular and you want it to be expressive of place. Well, you got to breed for that. And you need a seed company. It's not going to do a one size fits all that these beets do well here in the Pacific Northwest, in Southern California, in Mexico, Canada, and China, which is how most seeds are bred. No, you want something that is particularly expressive here and even more expressive in the Pacific Northwest. And that just takes breeding work. And I think that people are going to be recognizing that and want to pay for that kind of work in the future.
I think so too. I think you've just painted a very progressive and beautiful ideal in the future of food. So if that's the beautiful ideal.
And I'm a cynic, man. So I'm glad you said that. I'm going to tell my wife
cynicism.
You said that. I painted something very inspiring for the future. Good.
Well, what's the dismal future if we don't succeed?
Well, I mean, that stuff's painted all the time. You know, we're getting into this real dystopian food future. We're all going to be eating insects and jellyfish. You know, I just don't buy that. I mean, the way the climate's going, maybe we're going to be there before we know it. But I do believe that one of the great things about the movement that we've been involved in, in some striking way, I think, is all about hedonism and pleasure. What movement asks you to be greedy for the kind of stuff that you just tasted? There is none. Like the environmental movement's been giving up stuff. You know?
Yeah.
It's like you got to sacrifice. It's like religion. But it lasts about as long as this conversation. Then people are off and running with all these other things. I also think that's why the good food movement has legs. You know, it's like, it's just hedonism. That's one thing that Americans are very good at.
Yeah.
Figure out a way to pay more for something that tastes good and that's pleasurable. And that's the kind of food culture I think will drive this. And why everyone always asks me, don't you think the local good food movement, whatever, organic, isn't it dead? Isn't it hit its apex? It's like, it's just beginning. It's like,
yeah,
we're not going back. It's like saying, like, we're going to go back to a time when we accepted less gay marriage. It's like, we're not going back. It's like the culture has accepted it. It's hit a tipping point or whatever, and now it's moving on. And I think that's the same thing with food. I think we're going to continue to demand these kind of flavors as we go on. So that's not cynical. That's even being more progressive and happy about the future. But I think it belongs to the gourmet, the future. And I do think these flavors will be more and more democratized. But we better start breeding for it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the flavors will ebb down to all levels in society eventually. We hope that. But I think that's got to be tendentially empowered with better education within food all levels,
right,
mostly in the public school systems. I think we're really keen, you know, chefs have always been like, oh, well, let's jump into the cafeterias and fix the food system from there. But I think there's an empowerment of individuals at a young age that needs to start happening more and more, because every kid should know how to cook this.
And you'll never accept anything less.
Because I realize we're in a Michelin-starred restaurant, but this should not be difficult to cook. No, there's one thing. This is a squash puree.
I just baked it.
Yeah.
And remember the expense, man. It's the same thing.
It's the cost of a squash.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't buy this thing that these flavors are elitist. They're not.
No, but if this is the new trappings of fine dining, I'm totally in.
Me too. And I want it out of the white tablecloth cathedral of restaurants. I want it in Walmart. That's the North Star of this whole thing. Is get it in because it's such a false choice. You can have good, nutritious food and pay a lot, or you can save your money and eat cheap. And that is a false divide. That's what the industry wants you to know. It's not true.
This
proves it.
I want goodness to be inexpensive.
Yeah,
inexpensive and cheap are completely converse.
But what you started with was exactly right. Is who's going to be where's the labor in all this? Who's going to be farming this? Because this isn't machine farming. This is we need people to farm this. We need work and we need people to cook it. It's the same problem.
Do you feel good about the future of farming in America?
I know you did that part, the Young Farmers Conference. Yeah, because all the money's all the money in tech is going towards, you know, 60 high story, you know, indoor growing hydroponic crap. It's crazy. It just makes me so angry. And that's where some of the best talent is going, is towards that kind of technology. Whereas the biological world and the farmland that's available to us, it's right outside our doorstep practically in every city. It's there or was there or it's disappearing. It's low hanging fruit. And that seems so striking to me, that it's that the opportunity there seems huge, and yet we're turning our backs on it. But you know, we love to invest in the whiz bang technology of the next new thing, the iPhone. And we don't have a language for the biology. We don't know how to describe how soil, microbial, and bacterial reactions work in an exciting way to make people grip onto it and invest it, because I don't know, they can't scale it or whatever. I don't know what the hell it is. So we don't have a fascination with it. We have a fascination with, like, you know, the Steve Jobs and the Bill Gates of the world. And that's in this case, is really unfortunate, because nature doesn't work like that. Biological systems too complex, too inefficient to invest your money in, which is how it's
doing. I have a fascination with people like John Kuykendall and you know, the seed saver at Blackberry Farm.
Oh yeah.
Or Tucker Taylor.
Tucker
was a farmer in Athens, Georgia.
That's right.
I live. Uh-huh. For years, and I remember him calling me. He's like, Thomas Keller's flying me out talk to him. And I was like, you should go.
Right.
That's cool. So, and he's still doing amazing work in the farming sector. And just when he grows Celtus and things like that.
Yeah.
Celtus.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, just awesome. His stuff's amazing.
Yeah.
So what was the impact of Chef's Table on life? Anything? Is it good? Were you proud you did it? Your episode was phenomenally interesting.
Thank you.
Yep. It was really interesting about the balance of work and life because they are intrinsically different.
Yeah, I haven't figured that one out.
No, nor have I. I don't think we ever will.
No. Well, what do you feel like now with your children at 14 and 16? Like, when you look back on it, because that's what keeps me up at night. It's like, what am I going to think when they're 14, 16? When I look back, am I going to be filled with regret? Or what would you do differently, I guess? I would spend more time with them, because everybody wants to spend more time with their kids.
But I'm a pessimist and optimist at the same time. I'm half full of regret. But I think as chefs and as people who have really tried to impact their communities or the food system as a whole, that requires a lot of time and a lot of commitment. Yeah. And I think we're still from the generation of chefs who built their own things, working 90 hours a week, and it took us away from everything that we're supposed to actually care about, and we created subsequent parallel families called restaurants.
Yeah, right.
And that's not a bad thing, but it's I think that we always need to suss out where at the end of the day our hearts lie and what we're really dedicated to.
Right, I'm figuring that out now. And what do they resent you for the hours, or do they like food?
They love food.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, they don't fight against that. And, you know, they're very bright, and they're very empowered, and they're very, they're their own people.
Yeah.
Both their mother and I have given them the space to grow up a lot of on their own. But, you know, I think that I try and make as much time as I can, given the confines. But, you know, the you have two restaurants, and, you know, the modern chefdom is having multiple restaurants.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just wish we could all go back to the European model 40 years ago, saying, I live above the restaurant.
That's right.
And it's great. That's right. And I choose my hours, and I close down for 3 weeks in the summer. I take a vacation. I don't worry about it.
Right.
I think
there's still Europeans doing that now. Here,
right? I know.
I don't know if that's an
But nobody's allowed to do that.
Not in New York.
States.
No, you can't. That goes back to the rents.
But then it does go back to the rents, and you have to be open all the time. To be open at Blue Hill, I don't know how you can make it without being open at lunch.
That's tough.
It really is tough. But it's a small kitchen. It's ever active, and it's just hard to fit those people in. So it's always a balance. I think what your kids need to know at the end of the day is that you're always available no matter what for them.
Yeah.
You
live near the restaurant, right?
Yeah. But I don't spend too much. I mean, I've got three restaurants, one in Atlanta, two in Athens. I've got some management contract deals. And I do a lot of writing and cookbooks and things like that.
When did you get out of the daily kitchen?
Probably about 8 years ago.
Oh.
And I'm not angry that I got out of the daily. I find myself cooking almost more than ever. I was talking to Tom Colicchio, and it was funny. He was like, I probably cook more than I ever have now, but it's just for two little guys at home and my wife.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's great.
Yeah.
You can, I think being a chef, as we think of it, is being the leader of a kitchen.
Yeah.
But I think what it's morphing to is being a really good baseball manager of a team.
Yeah.
You're putting a team on a field.
Yeah.
I thought this guy said this, and it was most approachable to chefdom, but it's Satya Nadella, who's the CEO of Microsoft now. He said, what to look for in leaders. He said, the ability to create clarity when none exists. I kind of extrapolate that to expediting and triaging a situation.
Yeah.
He said, having a leader should have a knack for sparking energy.
Yeah.
And then the leaders should have the ability to succeed in a pressured environment,
which
really made me think about chefdom, because it really is it's a very pressure-filled environment. But I think the successful chefs who are happy with the work that they've done and are content with the humans that they are can dispel the notion that all those things are difficult.
Yeah.
To me, it's a matter of happily triaging the situation every day that you walk into.
That's nice.
And you
nice.
Figure it out.
It's
you
nice.
Balance it.
I love it.
But you
can I take a picture of that?
I want to
use that somewhere.
You can have it.
No, really?
No, I've got it written down elsewhere.
Nice.
But yeah, I think that's the idea. And I think good chefs these days are the best trainers and educators more than ever.
Yeah.
That we're training in technique and the idea I think a little bit gone are the days of everybody wanting to cook like Farron.
Yeah.
Or Grant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Luckily.
Yeah.
There's a purity to food that exists right in front of us, looking at these beets and these squashes, that is now more reverential again.
Yeah.
It was once reverential.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to me, it's like I look at apple varietals because I'm in the South and we're surrounded by apples, and Arkansas blacks.
That's
one type of southern apple.
Uh-huh.
It's almost a black, dark hue. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful crisp varietal that only has a two-week window in North Georgia.
Oh, wow.
And teaching young chefs to appreciate that is so easy. You just have to put it in their hands.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So, but you're putting it in their hands with this stuff, and
we're
it's
hoping
amazing to,
man.
To see.
We're hoping to. Thanks for the inspiration.
Well, thanks. This has been delightful, Dan.
Thanks, man.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location by Brian Blum at Blue Hill in Greenwich Village. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mizell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, rate, review, and come back Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Thanks for listening. Enjoy spring. Eat well. Be swell.